Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm stand-up comedian James Mullinger and the co-founder of Edit Magazine. This is Mullinger Meets Canadians, the podcast where we meet Canadians who are making waves on the world stage. In this week's episode, I'll be speaking to the world-renowned chef Michael Smith and his wife Chastity Smith, an accomplished interior decorator and musician. This powerhouse couple are bona fide Atlantic Canadian legends, and they combined their talents in culinary arts, design and customer service to rethink and transform Prince Edward Island's Inn at Bay fortune. When they took over as proprietors, they grew the business by a whopping 600% and established the inn as a five-star destination, the only one of its kind on the island, with travellers flocking from around the globe to experience their epic nightly feasts. While Michael is a native of New York, he proudly identifies as being Canadian and was actually awarded the Order of Canada in 2019. He is also a top-selling cookbook author, 10 to date, and the host of several cooking shows, including Chef Michael's Kitchen, Chef at Home, and Chef Abroad, which appear on Canada's Food Network and in more than 100 countries around the world. Recently, Michael and Chastity opened their sister property, the Inn at Fortune Bridge, and I spoke with them about this unique addition, how they survived lockdown, the curse of tipping, what will save the Atlantic Canadian tourism industry, their favourite dishes, and what it's like being probably the most famous people in the Maritimes. Michael and Chastity, how are you?
Great, how are you?
Good morning, James.
Good morning. It is great to hear you both. How have you been coping during this kind of strange time that we're all living through?
Well, we're coping, James. I think we're basically doing our best to understand the challenges and to react to them. You know, we've had a very interesting winter. I think we all have.
How's homeschooling?
Oh, that stopped very quickly. How about you guys? I think what we did is we just tried to kind of create fun things that we can teach them. And I'm sure in both your cases, I mean, I'm sure those two things involved music and cooking, did they?
Yeah, to some degree. Chaz really took the lead on homeschooling here. I sort of kept working and Chaz devised an awesome day for the kids. And I mean, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. I don't want to sit here and suggest that this is, you know, put us on a pedestal or something. Every parent struggled with this, really. I mean, trying to figure it out. Yeah. Hell, trying to teach math in French.
Not to mention the fact that they were going to kill each other at the table. So come June, it was like, I'm done. Like, I can't do this anymore. So...
That is it. That is exactly it. I mean, yeah, my homeschooling became, here's the phone, go and play Minecraft or Fortnite. That was my...
build the Parthenon, go.
Yeah, that's it. But I mean, of course, I mean, like most people, you were obviously at home with the kids, but also finding ways to not only carry on running your business, but also ways of doing your business in a completely different way. How did you kind of, how did that thought process go? And how did you end up with the in at home concept, which was genius, by the way?
Well, thank you, James. I think in essence, the first step was seeing the challenge and understanding that the world was about to change and understanding that to move forward, we had to let go of the past dramatically, radically, immediately. In our case, that all sort of happened in mid-February. And we got right to work modeling what the season could look like. We had four models built by mid-February. One of them we're using now. What I didn't see, I don't think what we expected, was takeout. So right. When the world pivoted, I guess it would have been mid-March-ish, We started to see restaurants in our position all over the world start to explore takeout. And that it became very clear to us that if we were going to put our team back to work this year, we were going to have to explore takeout. So as we talked about that and thought about that, takeout quickly became picnic.
Right.
And it just, I mean, you know what it's like, James, you're a creative guy. It's hard for us to say to you, hey, this was the moment when we realized it. But it did. Yeah. It became very quickly, it became clear to us, we're going to do takeout. We're going to do picnics. Because gathering people around food is what we're all about. And,
right.
And, you know, taking out a burger and fries is one thing, but taking out a full meal for a family, a picnic, is quite another. And it's really not that different from what we've been doing for years here.
Yeah, it's true. It's the pandemic version of the feast. You're still bringing people together around food.
Sure, and we're outside. I mean, we're so lucky. We're so lucky, James, that our business is so outside oriented in the first place, that we have the land that we have, that we have the outdoor cooking facilities that we have. All of that has helped us pivot.
As I'm going around and painting the place the last 4 weeks, I realized that, you know, what we did in creating the feast in the first place, you know, we took a risk and we created a family style dining restaurant. And now we're, you know, I'm going around and both of us are, and inside we've gone from these large feast communal tables to deuces again, reversing what we changed 5 years ago. And it's kind of, it's disorienting, you know, it was the right move to make, but you know, it's crazy to, like you say, to just all of a sudden we're separating, you know, we've built this business on coming together and now we're separating a little bit, but like Michael was saying, the picnics have created a community just in a different way. So that's cool too, right?
Oh, I agree. And it's super smart. And I loved all the kind of different interactive ways that you brought people together with. You had the YouTube videos and the Spotify playlist. And it's just interesting because, again, I mean, almost every industry had to do the same thing where, you know, like, as you say, you hadn't necessarily thought of doing picnics before. I mean, in the same way I hadn't thought about doing, you know, comedy gigs via Zoom or in drive-ins. But you kind of go, right, well, this is the hand that we've been dealt. Let's find the best possible way to do this. But I guess my question is, do you feel like there are aspects of what you're learning now and doing now that could continue even when things go back to normal, whatever normal looks like?
Well, yes, absolutely. You know, part of our mandate, you know, through this whole thing, through all these years, has been to never let any idea disappear. Like, in other words, we evolve. Right. We're constantly evolving. And that's been our mandate, to evolve, to evolve, to evolve. So here we are at this point where, well, maybe this could be something that we keep going and do in addition to the feast, perhaps, or, you know, who knows how the feast will evolve. I mean, one thing's for sure is we always talked about reducing our numbers inside, you know, from an 82 seat restaurant, bringing it down, evolving the food to more small plates, and also creating a pavilion in the back of our building where we would do exclusive dinners for a smaller group with their own chef and creating things that way. So, you know, all of a sudden now we've gone from just the feast to, well, there's a potential for a picnic. There's potential now for the pavilion and how to do all of those things at the same time. That'll be the big question, right? Is the logistics of that. But
yeah, we were very clear with ourselves and with our team from moment one that the values that got us where we are the same values that are going to move us forward. Mm-hmm. That the challenge through this is not to lose our values. Mm-hmm. And as Chaz says, one of the things that defines the Inner Bay fortune that's in our DNA, if you will, is our ability to evolve, to put ideas on the table, to quickly try them and to realize they're working or not working and to constantly be moving forward. It's in us.
Yeah.
So that has put us in a very good stead now. And we said, too, from day one, we're not scrambling to come up with some short-term solution. We're modeling our future. And I think, legitimately, this picnic thing's got legs. The other thing that's really interesting to us, James, is that, let's be brutally frank here. We ran a restaurant last year with an average price of about $250 a head for dinner. We're serving picnics now for $34 a head. That's a very, very different market. Yeah. And Islanders are supporting us. So the right thing to do is to figure out how to support them moving forward. You know, our basket is basically a great big giant edible thank you. You know, with the way labor dollars are working right now, the right thing to do is just stuff more and more food in the basket because there's less and less labor in it. And so moving forward, the Islanders that are supporting this, we are going to hold on to them. We're not going to let this picnic thing go. You know, we've got a whole new crowd that's joining us, and we're honored by that, and we're not going to forget.
That's amazing. And again, I mean, like you say, I mean, right now, everyone's having to look within their own province for opportunities. But I mean, of course, traditionally, would you say the majority, 70, 80% of visitors to the restaurants were coming from outside of the province and or indeed outside of Canada?
Yes.
Not necessarily outside of Canada, but absolutely off island. Yes. 80% is a good, if anything, maybe a little low.
Our largest market was Ontario.
Right.
And then of course the Maritimes after that, and then the United States and the rest of the world. So
it's an incredible thing to shift. And I mean, you know, for all those years you've been bringing people. And again, I mean, I would find it all the time. I would go to, you know, a meeting in Toronto, and pretty much one of the only things that they would be aware of in the Maritimes would be the inn. That's what people know. They know what you guys do. How have you managed to create an environment where the locals have always been so supportive of you? And of course, you've been supportive of them. But quite often when people do come in and create a thing that is for people, you know, or is mainly targeting people from outside, how did you manage to kind of maintain that kind of love for what you guys do?
James, I think, you know, and this is something we've talked about a lot lately. I think what we're seeing is the result of a lot of community support from the business over the years and from ourselves and all the things that we do regularly and routinely. You know, the business supports a lot of small producers and we're so proud of that. And I think the world understands that we are, you know, cheerleaders for Prince Edward Island. So to see Islanders coming and supporting us, they know they're supporting their own community as well. They know they're supporting farmers and fishermen and producers in their community that we support. You know, and I can't, you know, again, we're not trying to put ourselves on a pedestal here. Every business is doing their best right now. But I can't overstate the importance of a $1.5 million payroll in your community. Okay? We have we're proud of the jobs we've created, and we're proud that they're good career track, well-paying jobs, you know, and I think that too is part of the support that we're seeing.
Definitely. I mean, the incredible thing is, of course, going back, you know, I imagine when you both visited there for the first time and saw the opportunity, there must have been people that thought that you were crazy to even think about pulling off such a kind of a, you know, when you said we're going to create a world-class restaurant in this tiny place and people are going to come from far and wide, people must have said you were mad.
Yeah, they did. Well, in my case, twice. I dealt with this in the 90s when I was first chef at the inn, the idea that we could create an awesome restaurant. Back then, I was wet behind the ears. I didn't know any better. I just thought, hey, we'll just do it, whatever. And so we did. Now I know better. And when we were getting ready to open, the whole idea of growing our own vegetables, no problem. Everybody gets that. And cooking with live fire, fine, awesome. But this idea of sitting strangers together, shoulder to shoulder, 5 years ago, that was scary. And everybody did not think that was going to work. So we stuck it out, we built it, and we'll stick it out again. You know, we're not going anywhere, and we'll figure out how to move forward, and we'll figure out what is going to honor our guests and honor this island and honor our staff the best moving forward.
Yeah,
that's incredible. I mean, again, as you know, I mean, I have never had a dining or, you know, really even had any type of evening experience like the experience I had there. And that is the one thing that people always say. No one ever forgets it. And that's what people want nowadays is they, you know, they want memories, and they're going to want memories even more so after after all of this. But can you both describe for me your first ever visits to America? You, of course, born in New York, and Chester, you were born in Newfoundland and Labrador. Can you describe the first time you visited the island and indeed the area and what your first impressions were?
Well, for me, I grew up here too. My parents had separated when I was quite young. And so I you know, spent years in Newfoundland. I was born there, obviously. First 5 years was spent there, or 6 years rather, and then came back here after my parents split up. So my impression, of course, of the island is that part of my family is here. So maybe I'm not the best one to answer that to you. But I guess in terms of the two provinces, for me, the island, you know, as our saying goes, the gentle island, it's always been that for me.
Yes.
First of all, I was just saying to my dad the other day that I can remember being in Newfoundland and, you know, it would be this peak of summer and we would be laying down on a car to try and get a suntan because the warmth would be in the car, right? Because it was so cold. So at least you'd have a little bit of remnants of summer, you know, the feeling of summer. So so here was like, oh, that place you could go to that was just like, oh, heaven. Yeah.
I remember my first moments on Prince Edward Island. I was driving a rickety old Jeep up from New York for the first time and made it as far as New Brunswick the night before, and the next day pile onto this ferry that's going to take me across to this island. And as I'm driving down the gangplank of the ferry on the PEI for the first time in my life, I'm tuning in CBC radio just for kicks, and they're doing the death announcements. And I'm thinking, what in the heck? Where am I? I've never in my life heard such a thing on the radio. And, you know, but I got to say, James, it's only gotten better. And, you know, for me, Prince Edward Island is who I am. I wouldn't be the man I am if it wasn't for this island, you know. Right. I'm a hard-driving chef, and that's not always the most positive thing. You know, there's parts of that that aren't necessarily good. You know, you push really, really, really hard. You work your ass off, and sometimes you forget the things that matter in life. And when you live on Prince Edward Island, that's awfully hard to forget. You know, and I know at a time in my life when I needed direction and guidance and community and meaning, I found it here. I feel pretty darn lucky for that.
I mean, as you rightly say, it gets talked about as a magical place, and people that live there feel it. People that visit there feel it, and it's you know, it's remarkable because it's always been a place that people wanted to go for numerous reasons. But you've created this destination, this reason. Where did the thought process come for the Inn at Fortune Bridge, and what's the kind of plan there now?
We had architectural drawings done up to create two modern farmhouses on the back of the Inn at Bay Fortune. That was our idea, 2 6-room modern farmhouses. Yes. And that was where we were going to go. However, fast forward 6 months later, this house comes on the market for the first time in 100 years. Well, 100 years ago it was built, and it was the same family that owned it all that time. The house came on the market, and it had stayed on the market for a couple of months. And at the same time, Michael and I both one day just said, whoa, why aren't we jumping on that? Because it'll never happen again. And it was a treasured home in our community. The Johnson family were the Fox ranchers. They had horses, they built boats, and they had the general store. And so it was a significant property. And we thought we could take that and restore it. And, you know, maybe that would be our next phase. And that's what we did. So Fortune Bridge is the sister property to the Inn at Bay Fortune. We have that open now, a couple of rooms, that is, because of the way the building is laid out. There are two rooms outside with views of the horse stables and field. And the other rooms are inside. And so we felt it wouldn't be... It wouldn't work for anybody staying inside the building. So having their outside, their own private entrances would be best for this year. So it's kind of sad because I would like to see all the rooms open. It's a beautiful property. But, you know, we got to do what we've got to do. And, of course, you know, in terms of housekeeping standards, we've always been unprecedented with our cleaning procedures. And now we've gone even steps further. So we're quite proud of that, knowing that people or believing that people are way safer staying with us than going to the local grocery store. So
it's a sanctuary. We've tried to create a sanctuary, you know, a place where you can go and relax and know that you're safe and just keep it simple.
So we've reduced our prices for the rooms and also included the farmhouse supper with that or in that pricing.
It's a heck of a deal.
Yeah.
Because the farm through all of this, our farm, we never stopped. If anything, we accelerated. Like we didn't know what the year was going to look like, but we knew we were going to need vegetables somehow. So the farm is just, the farm's having a great year right now.
That's amazing. I mean, the thing is, you've kind of pivoted so perfectly and seem to have, you know, been able to, A, as you say, like explore things that you had been talking about anyway, and then, of course, creating completely new concepts like the picnic. Were there some days of sheer despair in the early days of the pandemic?
Still are. Stop beating around the bush, James. This is this is all, you know, okay, fine, thank you. Yes, we've pivoted successfully. We've come up with some good ideas, yes. But this is not in any way, shape, or form replacing the business that we had in the past. We think we've stabilized our business for 21. We're virtually certain of that. There's a few I's to dot and a T or two to cross. But really, at this point, the picnics, the rooms, everything we're doing this year, the inn is not going to benefit from that. Our families are going to benefit from that. The people that work for us, that's why we're doing it. Honestly, James, if we were strictly brutally business, we'd look at the numbers, and the numbers say very clearly, don't open. Do not open. So when you ask if it's if there's fear, there's fear. I mean, we're living with it right now. We're living with it every week, trying to make sure this business just grows to the degree that the picnics will support the folks that are working.
Well, I commend you for that. I mean, it's that kind of commitment to people and place that has obviously, you know, is obviously why both of you are so kind of widely embraced. And congratulations also on the Order of Canada. That that must have been a nice feeling.
Yeah.
Thank you, James.
He cried. Very humbled.
I still am.
Yeah, it's pretty humbling, you know, both of you being from different places other than Canada. I mean, you know, this place is so special, and to be recognized for all that you do for this place is hugely validating. And
it's incredible achievement. And as you say, to be someone who's come here, seen the opportunities here, seen also what can be embraced. I mean, I know you were inducted for contributions as a chef entrepreneur and champion of local foods and efforts to develop regional tourism. I mean, the combination of, as you mentioned, this kind of support of local, but also the tourism industry as a whole. What things do you think that the tourism industry could and should be doing right now to help itself? Or is there anything?
Oh, boy, James. There's a lot. You know, I think, as I said earlier, you know, first and foremost, to move forward, you have to let go of the past. And honestly, not so much hotels, but within the tourism industry are many, many, many restaurants with a very, very flawed culture. And we in Canada, in North America, with this ridiculous system of tipping, we've got to let that go. We've got to move past that. It is part of inequality. It does hold people down. And when restaurants perpetrate this or keep this system going and allow guests to think that food is all about the lowest possible cost, it's about the price, how low is it, it's price, price, price. And then we dance this ridiculous dance with servers, this idea that, oh, if I don't get good service, I'm not going to tip, when no data shows a correlation between the two. You tip because you feel guilty. It's the weirdest darn thing. And beyond weird, it's harmful. And I'm sick of it. And I'm sick of the general public ignoring this and not understanding the harm that they're doing to working families all over Canada. In our business, we refuse to do it. As you know, we are a hospitality-included business. We are open and transparent. We say to the world, there's a service charge. And by doing that, we are able to support our staff the way they should be supported. I mean, as an example, they all have this. After a year with us, you get the exact same health benefits that our own family has. And that's because we refuse to dance with these tips. So moving forward as an industry, we need to recognize that there are some things that we were not doing well, and we need to fix them. And that's one of them.
That's so true. What will it take, do you think? What will it take for people? You would think that people would listen to you, of all people. Why is it not happening?
It's so entrenched, James. It's just so entrenched. Like, you've traveled the world. You know what it's like. Yeah. We're the only place in the world that does this. And it has roots in racism. Tip, you know, to ensure prompt service from the porter on the train. The guy who was so disrespected, you probably didn't even see the fella. And all these years later, TIP is still part of our world, and it has straight up racist roots.
It's crazy. And as you say, I mean, you know, I wasn't aware of it in England, and then I came here, and it's everywhere. And as you say, it is guilt, and it's
It's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. It is disrespectful to hardworking folks out there, moms, single moms, dads. Everybody is trying to make a go of it in our business. To have to dance with this ridiculous issue. There's even places in North America that where you're allowed to pay sub minimum wage. Less than minimum wage as an employer, because the expectation is that your staff is going to hustle a tip. How wrongheaded. That is not our Canadian values.
No, it's criminal. And I mean, the way that, of course, you know, you have been, you know, very strict about that. And of course, I mean, your staff loyalty speaks volumes to that, to the way you treat them, to the way that you embrace them. As you say, you treat them all like family. How do you recruit? Like, what is the recruitment process? I mean, because you seem to have the best of the best there. So how do you get those people?
Well, it's beneficial that we have such a social media pull, you know, that's that helps, right? Like,
I think, though, the key, James, is that we set a high bar.
Well, that, yeah.
You know, we expect, like, for Chaz and the hotel, we're able to hire from our community around us. And everybody understands it's a great job. You're going to work hard, but you're going to be so respected.
And I,
you know, for the cooks, though, we draw from across the country, in some cases around the world. A different cohort of folks that, you know, that want to be a part of this. But overall, I think the secret here is that we just have extremely high expectations. We expect the best.
But I think it's also, word of mouth spreads, you know, the chefs, it's not a large, you know, group to begin with, really. So they're going to hear about us somehow and about how we're treating people. And that's why they want to come work for us, you know?
For sure. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, as you say, people, when you treat people well and you do good things and people have great life experiences, they tell people. And as you say, I mean, you mentioned there, of course, the incredible, you know, social media following that you have. I mean, the following that you both have is global, thanks to obviously the reputation of all that you do, but also through the TV shows and everything else. How do you cope with, like, being, because you must sometimes, when you hit the Sobeys on the island, you must sometimes feel a bit like the mayor of and people must be coming up to both of you all the time. How do you kind of deal with that kind of attention, if you will?
They don't.
Really?
They just don't.
What? Maybe just alone.
We're old hats around here.
Yeah, I mean, James, it's 20. That's been going on for like 20 years. So everybody's had their picture now. Everybody's got their cookbook.
Everybody's had their picture. You know, nobody cares.
But honestly, it it's off island where it's a bigger issue, and it's not. That's a tough one to answer, James. Like, it can sound so disingenuous. You know. At heart, I'm actually an extremely introverted guy, and yet, you know, I have a very extroverted job. I can't explain that. I don't know how that works, but it works for me. And you know, as a chef, with hospitality in my soul, all those years of meeting all those people who just want that moment, that just want that quick conversation, that pat on the back. What a wonderful opportunity. you know, to just take a second out of your day and smile and chat for a moment and say something light and make somebody else's day. I mean, that's what chefs do. So no problem over all those years. But never something that, James, it's not my lifeblood. It's not something I crave or need. I don't need that validation. You know, it's a really interesting thing to be in the middle of. And after 20 years, I don't fully understand how it all works, honestly.
You know, what's sort of out of the positives that's come out of this pandemic. One of them, I think, is forcing everyone to slow down. And for me personally, slowing down has opened my eyes even more to how great our little community is and how little I actually need, you know, like I don't want to go to town. I'm quite happy with, and I mean Charlottetown or, you know, anywhere really. Like, I'm quite happy just becoming a homebody and, you know, obviously working on our business, but I feel grateful for what we have. And I feel just quite at peace, really. You know, there might be fear associated with our business or uncertainty that is, but I don't know if you felt that way where it's just like, oh, wow, like we're okay. We're not, nothing bad is happening to us in particular. Like, I think that's part of what we need to do, you know, is this is, we're so fortunate to be where we are. And we can look at the world, look at the news and get all scared and fearful and like, oh, everything's going to hell. But right in our own personal lives, that's where we have to focus. You know, we have to be grateful for what we have, and that's what's going to give us peace. I hope you understand what I mean. I'm not saying bury our heads or anything in the sand. I just mean that we all have to just look at our own lives and look around and, just be grateful.
I agree. I mean, this is the thing is that I think, you know, almost any kind of book or movie or piece of art about a kind of a global pandemic or indeed any kind of global issue, we're always kind of led to believe for dramatic reasons that you know, these things bring out the worst in human nature. But the reality is that this has brought out the best in human nature. And actually, people aren't intrinsically, you know, liable to do the kind of the worst thing and look out for themselves. Everyone is kind of looking out for each other more than ever. And as you say, I mean, that is something to be embraced. And I agree. We're blessed to live in a place. Let's face it. We're blessed to live in a place where we were already social distancing before it was even a thing, right?
Yeah. That's it.
We're all like, you know, it's just so funny. Suddenly, I mean, obviously, you have people in Toronto, New York, London being told they've got to be however many meters apart. Tell us that in New Brunswick or PEI, and we're like, yeah, we've been doing that for a couple of decades now.
Oh, I know. It does make you sad to think about those people, though, that have to live in those big cities and they can't get out and they can't go out in nature. And they, it's just, that's terrifying.
Yeah. But if it does create a kind of an appreciation for, and, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more people moving to our parts of the world as a result of this.
I think you're right, James. Permanent tourists. Why would you, you know, with all this remote working,
I know.
In the expensive place with the view of the other expensive place, you know, the balcony across the street?
Right.
When you could be looking at a just nature, living in it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And my final question is something which I'm sure you've both been asked a million times, and maybe the answer to this question changes every day. I don't know. But what is both of your favorite thing to eat and your favorite thing to prepare?
You first, babe.
My favorite thing to eat is good old Caesar salad.
Nice.
Made by Michael.
My favorite thing to eat is this sort of Southeast Asian noodle salad you're making these days, babe. That's my favorite thing.
Like a peanut hoisin sauce with like all these vegetables and salad and sesame seeds and chicken. Wow. Oh, it's so good.
And I think underlying both these answers is, again, that subtext of we're enjoying this together. We're together. You know, this is with family. This is with friends. These meals, this food.
Yeah, that's what we do. You know, we have supper together every night as a family. It is forced, but you know, I don't know if it's as forced as
it's not really forced.
I just mean we enforce it. We enforce it. Yeah. Yeah. We enforce it. That's important just to connect, you know, at least to have that supper together. But we tend to do more of that these days than have supper. In fact, our daughter, daughter and son, Gabe, Gabe is working in the restaurant helping prepare the picnic baskets. He's 18, almost 19. And Ariella, who's 11, is helping in housekeeping. And Camille's got a career in stand-up comedy, I think, James. So
Fantastic.
Send her over there with you to shadow you.
Please do. I have an intern program going here.
You just want somebody to call you sensei, don't you?
That's exactly it. It doesn't happen often enough.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you both so, so much for your time. And thank you again for, I mean, everything you do to put the region on the map, but also for everything you've done for your community and the way in which you've inspired others to look out for their communities as well. So thank you so much. I salute
thank
you both.
You, James, you too do the same. You know, for somebody that came to this place from another country, you with this magazine, you and your wife, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's artistic. And I'm proud to know that you're in our community. So thank you, too.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Thanks, guys. Love you lots. See you soon.
Take care, James. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Mullinger Meets Canadians. If you like greatness, creativity, being inspired, laughing, or just love Canada as much as I do, then this is the podcast for you. So please do subscribe and review the show now. And be sure to visit Chef Michael and Chastity Smith at the Inn at Bay Fortune at your earliest convenience. Trust me when I say you won't regret it. Further details can be found on the Edit website, maritimeedit.com. See you all next time.
Podstarter.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.